KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
This is a theme we're seeing in races across the country. Everyone's pitting the business person against the politician and arguing over who is best.
Next time you're home and you already have something on the stove, like, why not just throw on a pot of beans?
There's something about it that's so friendly and positive, and when you hear it, it just puts you in a very peaceful state.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell, sitting in today for Steve Scher. You just heard ukulele musician Jake Shimabukuro speaking right there about the ukulele. He's going to be in the studio playing in just a little bit. And you also heard Amy Pennington talking about the Urban Pantry. She'll teach us how to build one and how not to just blow a bunch of money buying things that we think we should get. And you also heard Jill Jackson talking about congressional races. We've been focused a lot on the local election issues and the race for president on Weekday. And today we're going to take a look at the national picture. What could the House and Senate look like in the coming years? How many seats do Republicans need to take the Senate? And can the Democrats actually win back the House? Jill Jackson, Capitol News Hill news producer for CBS News, joins us with a look at the close races across the country. Hey, Jill.
Hi, Katie.
So you're in New York.
We're in New York, madly preparing for election night.
Oh, that sounds fun. Yeah, you're in the busy time right now, aren't you?
Yes, there are a lot of interesting races.
Well, let's start really basic. Can you just remind us what the current makeup of the House and Senate are at the moment?
Sure. Let's start with the Senate. So there are 53 Democrats in the Senate right now, 47 Republicans, and one-third of the Senate is up for election every 2 years. So this year, we have actually 23 Democrats defending their seats and 10 Republicans defending theirs. For Republicans to take back the Senate, they're going to need four seats, four net wins, essentially. So they can't lose any of their own. They need to gain a net of four seats. There is one exception, which is they could win the Senate with three if Romney wins the presidency, because a Vice President Paul Ryan would act as tiebreaker as president of the Senate. And right now, not all these seats are competitive, but we see about a dozen that are pretty exciting, especially seven toss-ups: Maine, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Virginia, Wisconsin, North Dakota, and Montana.
Wow. So I know that one of the things that was a surprise was Olympia Snow retiring this year.
Actually, two things have made it far more difficult for Republicans to actually take back the Senate. One was the retirement of Republican Olympia Snow in Maine, as you said. The other, and actually to walk back on that, when she retired, it left open what should have been a win for the Republicans, and now we have a three-way race in Maine. We have independent Angus King. He's a former two-term governor in Maine, and he is not saying which party he'll caucus with, although everyone assumes he would be with the Democrats because he said he's going to support President Obama. But there's a Democratic candidate, there's a Republican candidate, and right now both national parties are kind of playing this weird game of the Democrats are just attacking the Republican and they're not actually supporting their Democratic candidate. And the Republicans are just attacking Angus King, trying to bring his numbers down and do anything they can to prop up the Democrat to take votes away from King. So that's pretty exciting there. Then the other problem for Republicans, as we all saw over the summer, was Todd Akin in Missouri. The senator who's an incumbent there, Claire McCaskill, was considered the most vulnerable incumbent. Congressman Todd Akin won the Republican primary and then made a pretty extreme remark where he said, in, quote, legitimate rapes, that a woman's body can shut down and prevent pregnancy. So that caused quite a firestorm. Even, you know, Mitt Romney distanced himself from, actually called for Akin to step aside and let a new Republican candidate run. The entire national Republican establishment asked him to step down. He's refused. He's fought on, but all polls show him way behind. So that just makes the Republicans are starting too behind where they should be.
Well, let's talk about, like, just jump a little bit to talk about what happened last night with another comment about rape that's in the news this morning. What can you tell us about that?
Well, one seat that's supposed to be a fairly achievable pickup for Republicans is in Indiana. Or I guess this would not be a pickup, but it would be should stay in the red column for Republicans with Indiana State Treasurer Richard Murdoch. Now, he beat a long time, he's a Tea Party candidate, beat a long time Republican incumbent Dick Lugar in the primary, and in a debate last night with his opponent, Congressman Joe Donnelly, who's the Democrat, he said that, quote, even when life begins in the horrible situation, he's discussing rape, that is something that God intended to happen. Now, he's been trying to walk that back since, but it's already caused quite an uproar, and it's when the National Republicans, from Mitt Romney down to all of these races, which are so tight, they're so focused right now on trying to win the women's vote, especially the women make up 51% of the electorate. These sorts of comments just really don't help them. In fact, it hurts them, though I think it's too soon to say whether Murdoch's comments will actually change the game in Indiana.
Well, the question about abortion has become actually a pretty big issue in this campaign across the entire country, and along with women's issues, of course. How is the abortion issue shaping things? Is it really that big of a deal, or is it getting the most hype in the media?
I think that it does get it. These comments get a lot of attention, but at the same time, there's such a sliver of undecided voters that in some ways all these issues really count. And there are a lot of women out there that where this is something that they would actually that really will be a factor in their vote. We've seen in recent polling that it's something that a lot of undecided women are considering and weighing. So these issues do matter, and it does drive it. These sorts of comments hurt Mitt Romney at the top because it gives President Obama an opportunity to paint the Republicans, including Romney, as extreme on this issue, especially if certain people are saying there's no exception to no exception for abortions, for life of the mother, rape or incest. These are just comments that can hurt the brand when you're trying to win independence.
Well, let's look at the House a little bit. Is it possible for the Democrats to take back the House in this election, or is that improbable?
It's going to be very tough. So every 2 years, every seat in the House of Representatives is up for re-election. Right now, the Republicans control it with 242 seats to the Democrats' 193. The Democrats need 25 net seats to win back the House. And right now, that's looking very, very difficult. In fact, most analysts say it's going to be tough for Democrats even to get single digits. That being said, there are plenty of good stories on the House side. I mean, we have competitive races with some of the Tea Party stars. Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, one-time Republican presidential contender and founder of the Tea Party Caucus in Congress, is in the most competitive race of her career up in Minnesota's 6th District. You have Congressman Alan West down in Florida's 18th District. He is a Tea Party favorite. He's an African-American former lieutenant colonel who has called the president maybe the dumbest politician around and is regularly saying things that are popular with sort of the cable television world, but give the leadership in Congress some headaches. He's in a very competitive race. And then you have Congressman Joe Walsh in Illinois' 8th District. He has been an ardent Tea Partier, and he also got into one of his own issues related to abortion recently, where he suggested that health of the mother is just an excuse for women to have an abortion, and that it really is not, it should not be an issue. But he also is in big trouble, mostly in his case because of redistricting. His district is far more Democratic than it was before, and he only won by a few hundred votes in 2010 to begin with. So we're looking at those stories. There's also, you have incumbent versus incumbent races because of redistricting, because every 10 years when the census is done, the reapportionment of districts around the country based on population. So there's sort of a game of musical chairs of incumbents fighting to the death. Eight have gone down to their to their colleagues in primaries, and there will be five races on election night, including one in California that has become, the shorthand now is Berman-Sherman, because it's Congressman Howard Berman versus Congressman Brad Sherman. The two very long-time incumbents are neck and neck fighting for their careers, and got so heated in a recent debate that Congressman Sherman actually looked like he was going to get physical with Congressman Berman, and a sheriff's deputy had to separate the two.
We're speaking with Jill Jackson. She's a Capitol Hill producer for CBS News, and we're taking a look at what's going on nationally in the election. So, Jill, you mentioned redistricting, but one of the things you highlighted when we were discussing this earlier was that the House could see an increase in Hispanics serving this year.
That's right. It actually, you know, a lot of the population increases that we saw during the 2010 census was a rise in Hispanics. They now make up nearly 17% of the population, and that's going to be reflected in the next Congress. It looks like if they have a good night, there could be around a 30% increase in the number of Hispanics in the House. That being said, it still would just be 8% of Congress, so it's not exactly the an accurate representation of the country. That we see similar trends with women and African Americans as well.
Another thing I want to touch on before we're out of time is, in Washington state races, some of our candidates are making a point of allying themselves with the president or with Governor Romney. But I understand that in Montana, both of the candidates there are trying to distance themselves from the president. Can you explain why?
That's right. Well, Montana, both candidates are trying to appeal to sort of the rugged Montana mentality. We have the incumbent, John Tester, who's a Democrat. He is a 300-pound farmer with a flat top. And seven fingers, and he won in 2006 sort of against the odds because Montana is a fairly red state. He's being challenged by Congressman Denny Rehberg, who Montana only has one House seat, so he's already won statewide. But the two are basically, he's playing sort of the rancher, he's a Tea Party member, but he joined the Tea Party caucus, but he's trying not to embrace that now. And he's sort of talking about how he's the real outsider because John Tester voted for the health care law, the stimulus bill. And there's this very funny ad. The Rehberg campaign found a pair of I would guess, mid-60s twins dressed exactly alike. And I would encourage you guys to look this up because it's very funny where the two talk about how President Obama supports cuts to Medicare, and so does John Tester. And, you know, it's very, very hilarious trying to make it out like President Obama and John Tester, this 300-pound man, are twins.
Yeah, I'll have to look that up. Maybe we'll post it on our Facebook page.
But Rehberg is also trying to distance himself from Mitt Romney as well, and just really trying to paint himself as this rancher type who represents Montana's interests better than John Tester would.
Speaking with Jill Jackson from CBS News, Jill, you've covered quite a few elections now in your time. What do you think of the tone of this election cycle versus other elections that you've covered?
I think the tone every election seems to get more and more negative. It seems that also, I would say, not only negative, but aggressive. I think we saw that in the presidential debates, although not on this last one. But I think that there's a real sort of, I've been thinking, I wonder if it comes from sort of the cable mentality of people feel like passion, to show that you have the fire in the belly, to show that you have the passion, to show that you have to win, that you have to go to, you have to be the loudest one in the room, you have to be, the interrupter, the one who makes just extremely exaggerated claims about lawmakers' records, because that's what you have to do to just get voters' attention and cut through the noise. I mean, we were told in months ago that, you know, the real goal for both campaigns, both presidential campaigns, was to break through. There's so much news out there. There's so, you know, Twitter, Facebook. Everyone has so many different places that they can look, and they can also self-select what they're reading and watching. And so the goal of these folks is to break through and somehow get on their radar screen. And I think that we're seeing that the way that's being done is through this incredibly negative and use of exaggeration.
I was curious about you personally. I know that a lot of listeners are getting to that point now where they've decided on who they want to vote for, and they're getting pretty sick of all this negative talk and the back and forth. Quite a few people even wrote to us and said that they were not going to watch the debates on Monday, you know, anymore. So what do you think? As a person who has to cover this and be in the trenches, are you getting weary of this election?
Yes.
The short answer.
That being said, these folks are characters. I mean, they're really... are some great stories out there in all these individual races. I mean, you have the battle in Massachusetts with Elizabeth Warren and Scott Brown. That is just fascinating, because if Brown hangs on, it will be really quite a feat in Democratic Massachusetts. If Elizabeth Warren wins, it will be this huge consumer advocate coming to the Senate. I also think, you know, you have in Wisconsin, you have Tammy Baldwin, who, if she wins the Senate seat, she would be the first openly gay lesbian to serve in the Senate. You have, you know, just some really, really great stories in Virginia, the tale of two former Virginia governors battling it out. So I have to say that I still get very interested in when you delve down into the actual races, I still am very interested. At the same time, I'm sort of more interested at this point, and let's see what happens during the election so that we can move on to the looming fiscal cliff in Congress and see how they're going to deal with that.
Jill Jackson is a Capitol Hill producer for CBS News. Thanks so much, Jill, for taking the time.
Thanks, Katie.
This is Weekday.
It's 9:21. I'm Andy Hurst. Last month, gubernatorial candidate Rob McKenna came into the KUOW studios and laid out his vision and goals for the state of Washington. Today, we'll hear from Democratic Congressman Jay Inslee. He sits down with KUOW's Ross Reynolds this afternoon at 12:20.
Support for KUOW comes from UW Medicine Hernia Center at Northwest Hospital, established to serve the entire region, featuring surgical specialists dedicated to treating patients with all types of hernia conditions. More information online at uwmedicine.org/hernia.
Clouds, showers, and 48 degrees in Seattle. Forecast calls for a high of 51. We're expecting clouds and rain the rest of today. Tonight and tomorrow, however, clouds with a chance of showers. Tonight's low 40, tomorrow's high reaching 53.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell, sitting in for Steve Scherer today. An online encyclopedia about the waters of Puget Sound is being launched today. The idea is to collect and combine the best possible information from experts on the Puget Sound in an effort to restore and protect it. They're calling it curated crowdsourcing. And joining us to talk more about it is Joel Baker. He holds the Port of Tacoma Chair in Environmental Science at the University of Washington and is the Science Director of the Center for Urban Waters in Tacoma. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So why did you decide to create an encyclopedia about the Puget Sound specifically?
Well, you know, the Puget Sound is really a complicated system, and we know that in order to affect stewardship of the system, we need to understand the entire thing. And that's quite a daunting challenge. And one of the things we've discovered is that not one single person knows everything about something as complicated as Puget Sound. So we really need to form a team. And we're blessed in this region with lots of really smart people, lots of scientists and engineers who've worked on Puget Sound for a very long time. And the intent of the Encyclopedia of Puget Sound is to provide a forum where they can bring their information into one place and where they can go to get information from others.
So what makes it different from other databases or other information that's out there is that you're trying to get it all together instead of it being scattershot across the web?
Yeah, that's part of it. You know, the interesting thing is that there's lots and lots of data. We live in this age where data just streams in all the time. In some ways, we're flooded with information, flooded with data. But science really requires digestion. It requires time to reflect on what the information is telling you. It requires time to talk with your colleagues on things. And so the encyclopedia is really meant to be, in some ways, sort of a coffee house, a place where people can go online and discuss the issues of the day with their colleagues.
Do you expect it to be mainly used by scientists that are studying the Puget Sound?
We do. We describe it as something that's created by scientists for scientists. There's lots of very good websites about Puget Sound that are they're geared more towards the general public or through K through 12 education, things of that nature. Although you know, the encyclopedia is likely to be useful for others, it's really geared towards the scientists and engineers who are actively engaged in the profession.
One of the things I liked about it when I was just perusing around was the species library. Personally, just because I like critters. But how are you collecting those pictures and information about different creatures that are in the Puget Sound?
The Encyclopedia Puget Sound does have a species library, and I give Jeff Rice, our managing editor, lots of credit for pulling that together. And that's a collaboration with an organization called NatureServe. And as incredible as it sounds, there wasn't a single coherent list of all the species that exist in Puget Sound. So the encyclopedia sought to bring those together. And it's an example of the kinds of things that we can do where we're not creating new information, but we're taking advantage of others who have pulled together information and bringing it into a single place for Puget Sound that's easy to access and easy to use.
I know that you're doing a kickoff event and a panel discussion to celebrate this new encyclopedia that's being held at the UW School of Aquatic and Fishery Science Auditorium today at 3:30 and open to the public for anyone who wants to go. What are you going to be talking about there for the panel discussion?
Well, we have on the panel both local scientists, but also we've brought from the Encyclopedia of the Earth and the Encyclopedia of Life, which are two similar kinds of efforts that are already underway, one based at Harvard and the other one is really focused on life sciences issues. There's a lot of technical issues related to how you pull these encyclopedias together, and there's lots of issues related to how do you review information that comes into you, how do you archive it, and this idea of sort of crowdsource curation is a new idea for us. So there's lots of issues about how you incentivize scientists to participate and how you evaluate what goes into the encyclopedia and how the editing process works. So the discussion is really about all those aspects of it.
I'm talking with Joel Baker about a new online encyclopedia about the waters of Puget Sound that's being launched today. But when you're talking about crowdsourcing, you're not talking about me writing some article about, you know, a fish I saw while scuba diving and sending it to you.
we're not, and we really struggled with that because the original idea of the encyclopedia was let's just open it up to the entire world and have people send us everything, and then we'll sort through it. And we found that really wasn't the productive way to proceed. So we have a select group of 9 leading scientists from the region that form our editorial advisory board, and they're the ones that are really helping us evaluate the. You know, what data, what information should be pulled into the encyclopedia. We do have the ability for anyone to access the encyclopedia and to provide comments, but that's more in a sort of a commenting mode as opposed to creating new content.
Well, and just finally, how is this project actually being funded?
This is a part of the Puget Sound Institute, which is a collaboration between the University of Washington and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the Puget Sound Partnership at the state level. So the funding comes from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
And what are your aspirations for this encyclopedia?
Well, my aspiration is it persists, that 20 years from now it's still there, and that the scientists and engineers in the region see this as the place to go. I would love it if everyone had this was their homepage when they turned on their computer in the morning. Would be remarkably successful.
Joel Baker holds the Port of Tacoma Chair in Environmental Science at the University of Washington Tacoma and is the Science Director of the Center for Urban Waters in Tacoma. Talking about a new encyclopedia of Puget Sound, and if you want to go to that kickoff event today, the doors open at 3:30, and it runs from 4 to 5:30 p.m. At 1122 Northeast Boat Street in Seattle. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
This is Weekday. Food food writer and organic gardener Amy Pennington teaches us how to build an urban pantry so that we can save money and always have the food on hand that we want. She's a food writer, organic gardener, and owner of Go Go Green Garden. She's also founder of UrbanGardenShare.org, a website that matches gardeners to unused gardening space across the city. And she's written several books, including Urban Pantry, Tips and Recipes for Thrifty, Sustainable, and Seasonal Kitchen. She came in at the end of last week to talk to me, and I asked her about the introduction in her book, where she says that the book is a guide to stocking a pantry, but not any old pantry, an urban pantry. So I asked her what the difference was.
Oh, well, urban pantries tend to be smaller. So my sister, for instance, lives in the suburbs, as many of my friends do, and they usually have those really tall, beautiful cupboards that, like, you open it up and the drawers slide out and you can organize things. And then there's, like, another cupboard across the way where you can put – and urban pantries, that's not the case. You know, it's usually if you have an apartment or a condo or even, like, those small little 800-foot square foot houses down in Beacon Hill, there is not a lot of cupboard space, and you have to put all your glassware, all your dishes, all your things, and your dry goods. So that's an urban pantry. You have to be selective and efficient.
So this will be the essences of what we need.
Yeah, yeah.
What does your pantry look like?
My pantry is pretty darn tidy. And it's funny because people, so often I'll meet people and they're like, I read your book, I love your book, and I have all my stuff in glass jars now, which I think is really cute and it is really pretty. But functionally, I found many years ago that that is the best way to store things. It keeps things reasonably airtight, but you can visually see what your, you know, quantity is. So, like, for instance, last night I was really hungry and I opened up my pantry and I was like, oh, I only have like 4 tablespoons of popcorn left. Like, I'm going to need to get that next time. So I just put it on my little shopping list, like popcorn for next time. So it gives you a quick reference.
Why should people even be interested in the idea of stocking a pantry?
Well, I think if you want to cook at home for whatever reason, some people do it for economics. Some people do it so that they actually slow down. Some people just would prefer to cook or like to cook. That's why you want to keep that pantry stocked reasonably so that you actually can start cooking at home more regularly.
And so if we have really limited space, can you give us the essences of what a pantry should be?
Yeah.
Like, what should be in there?
Yeah. So your pantry, typically we're talking about your dried goods, not so much the fresh pantry, although there are some staples you should always have around. For instance, onions, garlic. Doesn't matter if you're not going to use them in a recipe, you always want them in your kitchen because with those two things, you can actually make so much. You know, like, that's it's the basic cornerstone of a lot of recipes are your alliums. But anyway, in a dry pantry, you essentially always want to have some legumes, some beans of some kind. So I usually have dried chickpeas and, you know, dried some kind of a big broad bean. Those are my personal favorites. Some other people might like cannellini beans, those pretty white ones, or, you know, lentils or something like that. And basically, those are a really good source of protein, and they tend to cook quickly. Some of them, lentils will, not so much beans. But they're a good secondary source of protein that are super cheap, and you can make them really flavorful. So a lot of times what I'll do is just make a big pot of beans and then have them, you know, ready to go. So instead of, you know, flavoring that one dish, like if you had like ham hock soup or something with white beans, you would make that whole thing. And I don't do that. I make the white beans off the side. And then if I ever wanted to make that kind of soup, I would just put a cup full in. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. Well, before you go on with like other things that should be in there, let's talk about the beans for a second. Because
yeah.
I've always had trouble. I mean, it's not that I don't have them on hand, but I've had trouble using them because of this idea that, you know, you need to plan ahead, you need to soak them overnight.
Yeah.
You need to do all these things, and that seems to be difficult.
Yeah, you know, the thing with beans, well, so perhaps you are a crockpot candidate or a pressure cooker.
Does that mean I throw them in dry?
Yeah.
Into a crock pot?
Yeah. You don't need to soak beans overnight. It does soften them up, of course. And then I think you also then it helps break down the little enzyme that causes disruption in our digestive systems.
Mm-hmm. Nicely put.
Thank you. And so that helps with that process. But you don't actually need to soak them. And I have and still continue to do experiments where I just don't soak them at all and toss them in and see if it takes that much longer. And it kind of evens out. It depends on how old your beans are. So really, the most important thing is trying to use a bean that's really fresh. So if you're purchasing them in bulk, purchase them from a store that actually goes through bulk, like, you know, any of the co-ops. Usually that's how people shop, and so they go through them pretty quickly. That's always good. Or you can grow your own, of course, mm-hmm. and use those. But they don't need a soak, but they will take several hours. It's just there's nothing you can do about it. So you could save it for a weekend project. I mean, just last night, for instance, I was home cooking, and I'm busy, super busy, and I'm not really eating because I'm so busy. So I turned the oven on to make some roasted broccoli. And then I was like, well, shoot, I have the oven on. I might as well roast a bunch of other stuff. So I roasted some sweet potatoes, and I did a little onion sweet potato mix. And then I was like, well, gosh, I'm here. I should just do something on the stove. And then I just threw some turnips and some potatoes in a pot with some water for some turnip soup. And I didn't actually eat any of those things except for the broccoli. But you're just like planning ahead. You know, sometimes you have to plan ahead so that you have things available. So like next time you're home and you already have something on the stove, like why not just throw on a pot of beans?
That's a smart point.
Yeah.
I'm speaking with Amy Pennington, who's a food writer, organic gardener, and owner of GoGo Green Garden. And we're talking about her book, Urban Pantry, Tips and Recipes for Thrifty, Sustainable, and Seasonal Kitchen. So what else? You talk about legumes. Flours, sugars.
Yep, flours and sugars. So most recipes, sweet recipes that you want to make, you can get away with just having two sugars on hand, brown sugar and your regular granulated sugar. Flours, I always have whole wheat pastry flour, trying to eat a little healthier. So whole wheat flour has more of the germ. It's a little more fibrous for you instead of like a bleached all-purpose flour. So for the most part, I use all whole wheat pastry flour versus the white flour. And then I, of course, also have some other flours. There's a chickpea flour. I have oat flour. There's buckwheat flour, you know, just different things. But if for anyone who's just getting started or anyone who's like, yeah, I need a pantry makeover, I'm going to make this happen, don't go buy four flours to start with because you'll end up not using them. So just pick two or three or like one that you want to experiment with. So I always had whole wheat pastry flour. And then just through the years, I would be like, mesquite flour, what's that all about? I'm going to get that. And I would get it and just use it like crazy, and then it'd be gone. And then I'd be like, okay, barley flour. I'm going to try barley flour. And, you know, you just sort of try things out just in a pound or two at a time. So you're only making 2 to 3 recipes at most. And then you're done with that flour and you move on. Like any pantry, you want to stock it so that you're actually moving through the food. You know what I mean? Like you don't want it lingering for months on end.
Right. I mean, I guess that's part of the challenge is people who are listening to this now and are feeling inspired about, oh, yeah, that sounds like a great thing to do.
Yeah.
It's pretty easy to just go to the store and blow a bunch of money.
Yeah, yeah. Don't do that.
So
don't do that. I mean, you can't look at my pantry and be like, I want that pantry because this took years of just, I don't know, as a nerd. I didn't have boyfriends when I was in my 20s. I really didn't. Like, I just cooked at home alone a lot. And it was interesting and I really liked it. But I didn't go out and buy 8 things at one time. You know, you have to sort of start small. So I usually made things my focus. And then I had this whole like year long grain period where I just ate a ton of grains, like every grain you could imagine, and flour form and grain form. And that's sort of how I've come up with this sort of master list of things that are the most versatile and the most convenient and the most tasty.
And what about things like canned stuff? Is that something that's a part of your pantry?
No. I make preserves, so I can my own tomatoes every year, actually, which I will say in Urban Pantry, I either say that it's dumb or I don't have a recipe for it. I can't remember, probably both, because it's kind of expensive and canned tomatoes, you know, are just a dime a dozen. You can get them. However, for the last 2 years, I've been making my own sauce and it really is remarkably more tasty. Mm-hmm. But no, I can all my own things that I want to can and freeze in the season. It's so much cheaper. I mean, if you're really going to commit to cooking at home and you're actually a cook and you can make time, so much cheaper to buy things in season and just either freeze them or can them so you have them all year long. So I usually get corn and cut the kernels off and freeze some of that. I always freeze peaches because I love peaches for smoothies in the morning. with just a little sunflower butter. I just stock it with things all summer.
What are some of the most money-saving tips when it comes to the kitchen? Like, are there certain areas where people could be saving a lot more money than they are?
Yeah, don't buy paper towels. Use a linen cloth, A. buy everything whole. So if you want chicken, buy a whole chicken and learn how to break it down and stop being a big wuss about chicken bones. So stupid. And then you can save those bones and make your stock. So that is super, super, super economical. Anytime you have an opportunity to buy something by the pound at the store, you should do that. So if you are one person or two people, you don't need 4 broccoli heads. Just pick one of those out of the thing and get them. Same thing with celery. I never buy a whole celery. I just break a stalk or two off, you know, whatever I need. So those little things really help. And then also just being realistic about your schedule. I mean, there are times where I look at my schedule and I just know that I'm not going to be home. And so I'm not going to buy lettuce. It's just silly. It will be wasted. I mean, it's just planning, which sounds so boring. But once you do it, you know, for a month, you won't ever think about it again. I don't ever think about this stuff ever. I used to.
But now you've got it down.
Yeah, just it's like second nature. You know, like I was saying before, I just looked in, I made this mental note like, oh, popcorn. Put a note on my phone and like, that's it. Never going to think about it again.
I have 2 more questions for you to finish off. Just on that same note, actually, one of the things you talk about in the book is how when you're being economically connected to your food makes a difference. Can you explain that?
Well, I don't know if I can explain it, but I have always had to make economical decisions, especially because I work for myself and where my food is concerned. And I didn't like paying for things that I knew that I could either grow on my own or make on my own or whatever. So if you actually don't have a lot of money and you are really trying to budget properly, you have to be mindful about these details because you can shave off $100 here and there. And that really sometimes over the course of a year, you know, is a huge difference. Like that for me would pay off my huge doctor bill. I had to go to the doctor this August for some stuff. You know, it's just like those, it does economically tie you to your food when you're paying attention to it. And when you don't have the freedom to be frivolous. And for many years, I didn't have that freedom. And frankly, I still don't, you know, so I just try not to waste. And then just from an environmental perspective, I think is more important to me, you know, waste not, want not.
Then finally, how do you keep track of all the information? Like you mentioned, noticing that you were almost out of popcorn, but sometimes, especially if somebody is lucky enough to have a slightly bigger pantry, perhaps, like they're not in a really tiny apartment, but they're in a house.
Right.
How do you keep track of the rotation and all the different things that are buried in there?
Well, I think that that is really a problem. This is why people have problems, because the pantries are just too big. I mean, my sister, well, she has 5 kids, so she might not be the best example. But there are plenty of people, all my friends, Ronnie and Kat, just have a ton of food in the house. And there's only 2 of them or 3 of them with their daughter, Emmy. And so you just don't need that much. Like you don't need to stockpile like that, especially if you live in the city. You know, it's just not necessary. So even if you have a big pantry and you can shove it with a lot of food, I would try and suggest to people that you just keep what you need around and just work on that for a while. And you start, like, you'll realize that you actually don't need those 5 cans of green beans. And, you know, give them the Food Lifeline. They need it more than you do, probably. it's just a habit. It's anything we do. It's like exercise, you know. You do it enough and then you just don't even think about it anymore. But getting started is just such a mountain.
Mm-hmm. Amy Pennington is a food writer, organic gardener, and owner of Go-Go Green Gardens. She's also a co-founder of Urban Garden Share, which is a website that matches gardeners to unused garden space in the cities across the country. And she's written several books, including the one we've been talking about today, Urban Pantry Tips and Recipes for Thrifty, Sustainable, and Seasonal Kitchen. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
My son Ellington just had his 3rd birthday. And so I had this weird experience in the first year of his life where I would spend the day reading these incredibly dense, complicated neuroscience papers about the importance of the first years of life in a child's development. And then I'd go hang out with Ellington and play with stuffed animals and trains and make goo-goo sounds. And I would try not to get too self-conscious about what I was doing.
Author Paul Tuff talks about early factors in predicting childhood success. Hear more tomorrow night at 8 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from Walker's Renton Subaru, where Pacific Northwest adventures begin. New and used vehicle inventory and information online at RentonSubaru.com or at Exit 2 off 405 in Renton. Subaru. Think. Feel. Drive.
Clouds and showers and 48 degrees in Seattle's University District. Working towards a high today of 51. Forecast calls for clouds and rain all day. Tonight and tomorrow, clouds with a chance of showers. Tonight's low 40. Tomorrow's high reaching 53.
Support for KUOW comes from the litigation group at Ryan, Swanson & Cleveland. Lawyers in Seattle since 1897. Online at RyanSwansonLaw.com.
That's music of the Beatles by Jake Shimabukuro, a virtuoso performer called a ukulele hero by Rolling Stone magazine. Millions of people have seen him perform in person and on YouTube, and he's appearing tonight at Benaroya Hall at 7:30. Thanks for coming into the studio.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So that was a little bit of my While My Guitar Gently Weeps.
That's my all-time favorite George Harrison piece.
Yeah. So when you, it's interesting because you do both your own compositions, but you also do covers of songs like that, like we just heard. Can you explain, when you're going to do a cover, what you're listening for?
Oh, sure. I mean, a lot of times I'll just cover songs that I grew up listening to, you know. I mean, to me, when you cover the song of another artist, you know, it's simply like wearing your favorite basketball player's jersey. You know, it's a celebration of your love and admiration for that particular artist. And, you know, so in the past, you know, I love the Beatles, so I've covered a lot of Beatles tunes. You know, that While My Guitar Gently Weeps showed up on YouTube about 7 years ago, and that's what started, you know, my whole touring career. On my last album, I did an arrangement of Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody, you know, which was more of an extensive arrangement, you know, for string instrument, but it was a lot of fun. You know, it's very challenging sometimes, and you know, and a lot of times you can play the right melody and the right chords, but you know, it's you know, to really play a song, you know, you have to capture the spirit and the essence of the tune, and that's always a huge challenge.
Can you cover anything with the ukulele, or are there some limits?
I mean, I think that I always tell people, if you can hum it, then you should be able to play it. But okay. some things cannot be hummed. So
that's true. I guess that is true. We're going to listen as we go out of the interview today to you playing Time After Time by Cyndi Lauper.
Oh, great.
Which is another great one. So has it always been the ukulele for you?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Hawaii, and my mom played the ukulele. So she was actually my first teacher. You know, she put it in my hands at a very young age and taught me a few chords, and I just fell in love with it.
Yeah, and I know that you pronounce it with a more traditional sense than I do. Ukulele,
yeah.
What do you say?
In Hawaii, we say ukulele because it comes from the native Hawaiian words uku and lele, which means jumping flea.
So how does jumping flea relate to how the instrument actually works sounds? Maybe?
What I was told is that, you know, your fingertips look like little jumping fleas on the fretboard. So that's how it got the name ukulele.
No, I like that. Well, maybe why don't we have you play something?
Sure.
What are you going to play?
This is, you know, I just worked on a new record. It's called Grand Ukulele, and it was produced and engineered by one of my heroes, the great Alan Parsons.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is one of the songs off the record, and it's called More Ukulele. All right.
That's Jake Shimabukuro playing a song from his new album, Grand Ukulele, that came out October 2nd. Well, you've attracted the entire KOW staff to the windows here to watch. Is that
awesome?
Is it true that most people, when they see you for the first time, have never seen anybody play a ukulele like you do?
Yeah, I mean, I get a lot of comments from people, you know, and they'll come up to me like, oh my gosh, you know, I never expected, you know, that kind of music to come out of such a simple four-string instrument. And that's one of the great things about the ukulele. You know, like I always tell people at my shows that, you know, one of the best things about being a touring ukulele player is that audiences all over the world have such low expectations of the music. So it's, but I think that's what makes it so charming and just, it's just such a wonderful, friendly instrument.
Do you feel like you've somehow become an ambassador, a steward of the instrument?
Oh, I mean, I think of myself more as just a big fan of the ukulele.
Well, when you're composing these songs, when you're coming up with what to play, what kind of a composer do you consider yourself to be?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I just, I love writing. You know, I love trying to come up with new ideas and innovative ways of, you know, playing the ukulele. Like for, you know, on my latest album, Grand Ukulele, there was a song that I wrote by accident, actually. I was changing my ukulele strings one day and I put three strings on, and I was missing my third string. So I put the other three strings on, and instead of rushing off to look for another third string, I thought, hey, wouldn't it be cool to just play a song with three strings? And I started noodling around, you know, with the first, second, and fourth string, and then I came up with a piece. And you know, and sometimes I just come across little things like that, and it's always interesting, you know, because every song, you know, there's some kind of concept or an idea behind it, you know, whether I'm trying to mimic like a piano or a mandolin or even like a Japanese koto, you know, I'm always that's where I get my inspiration from, you know. And I think one of the things about playing the ukulele, it's because it's so limited in range, you know, you only have a 2-octave range. You really have to expand on things like dynamics and timbre, you know, tone color to make every song interesting.
Can you play us just a couple bars of what it sounds like when you're just playing three, for
sure.
An example?
Well, this is, you know, the traditional. Right, but you could get like a piano like sound like this, a dusta. You could even get almost like harp sounds. This is like a Japanese koto. You know, you could get like almost like a Spanish guitar flamenco. You know, I mean, there's just so much that you can do with this instrument, and it always blows my mind. And I love listening to other, you know, other instruments. You know, like taking a like classical pieces, like, you know, or stuff like. And just making it work on the ukulele, so it's. I have a lot of fun with it, and it's just you know, it's just. I think there's so much potential with this instrument, and the coolest thing about it is, you know, like I mentioned before, it's a very friendly instrument. I think people aren't intimidated or afraid to pick it up. You know, like other instruments, you know, sometimes like people think, oh, there's no way I could ever play the violin or the cello; it's too hard. You know, but with the ukulele, people don't see it as like a serious instrument, so they're not afraid. You know, they see it and they're like, I want to buy an ukulele, I want to play it, you know. And it's so much fun because the moment you pick it up, as long as it's in tune, you know, you can just take one finger and place it on the fretboard, and you can get that instant gratification. You're like, just play one chord and you're like, oh my goodness, I can do this, you know. And I think that's the beauty of the instrument.
Instantly on the beach.
Yes.
Well, I only have about one more minute, but can we just briefly, you worked with Alan Parsons on the last album, which of course worked with the Beatles, Pink Floyd.
Yes. Yeah.
Amazing, I'm sure. What did you learn from him?
Oh, gosh. He's just such a genius. But, you know, the coolest thing is on this record, we had everything from a 29-piece orchestra to bringing in people like Kip Winger, Simon Phillips. You know, I mean, it was just an amazing cast of musicians. But the coolest thing was everything on this album was played live. There were no overdubs. I mean, even with the orchestra, I recorded in the same room with the orchestra. We played together, and it was just one of the most incredible and inspiring experiences of my life.
Jake Shimabukuro is performing tonight at Benaroya Hall at 7:30. His latest album is called Grand Ukulele. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
This is Weekday. The sound of the day. That's the sound of a train crossing the railway drawbridge that goes over the Ballard Locks. Sound very familiar to people who live in Ballard, or tourists for that matter. Thanks to Weekday listener Ben for standing under the bridge and recording that familiar sound for us. I do love the sound of a good train. We want to hear the interesting sounds you're hearing. Record 30 seconds of the sounds that you encounter, or perhaps the sounds that you're making. Send it to us along with the story behind the sound and email it to weekday at kyw.org with Sound of the Day in the subject line. I'm Katie Sewell, sitting in today for Steve Scherer. Coming up next hour, Vaughn Palmer with Canadian News. Todd Bishop brings us with the latest technology news. And Robert Horton will be talking about the zombie movies of the 1930s to get us in the mood for Halloween. Stay with us.
It's a minute before 10 o'clock. Headlines from NPR News are coming up next.
Support for KUOW comes from Pacific Medical Center's 9 neighborhood locations, offering weekend and evening appointments for the entire family, which can be scheduled online through MyChart. Hours of operation and locations are available at pacmed.org.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.